Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'm delighted to welcome back to the program today Philip Kerr. Hello, Philip.
Hello, Vic. Nice to be back.
Philip, we've had you on the program a number of times. I think maybe this is the fourth time, and the preceding interviews were all on your Bernie Gunther series. And the last time we had you on the show, you said, you know, I'm giving Bernie a rest. This next book is going to be something totally different, and by golly, it certainly is. It's called Prayer.
Well, it is, yeah. These are the words, of course, that publishers greet with a certain horror, you know, when you sort of say, well, I'm just going to have a little break from my successful series so that I can write something unsuccessful. And that's how they, I think that's how they think it must sound. But no, nonetheless, if you spend time writing about the Nazis, then, you know, every so often you need to take a vacation.
I think it's funny that you just mentioned the fact that your publishers respond with horror, because after I read this book, I said to myself, you know, I could categorize this as a lot of things, but there's certainly an element of horror in this story.
Oh, definitely, yeah. It's meant to be it's meant to be a kind of modern Edgar Allan Poe, a kind of gothic police procedural, in the same way that another of my absolute favorite books and movies, The Exorcist, was essentially a, especially in the book, a police procedural that turned into something else. Hmm. It's often forgotten that the detective in that, who's Kinderman, who's played by Lee J. Cobb in the movie, is a sort of most of the time trying to investigate a murder that occurs in a Georgetown house and keeps coming up against the wall of his own disbelief. You know, he can't believe that actually the person who's responsible for the murder of this film director in the book is actually is Regan, the 14-year-old girl.
Hmm. This one is set in Houston, and I see on your recent book tour that was your first stop, and that you frequently, I know in the past, go through Houston. Is that how you got the original inspiration to set it there, just on your various trips through?
It certainly came into it, yeah. I think the first time I went, I had this book in the back of my mind. I mean, the reason I picked Houston to write about is because, not because I think the Texans are sort of any more swivel-eyed and lunatic than anybody else. In fact, I found they were actually completely the reverse. They were very nice, courteous, decent people. No, the reason I picked Houston is because it actually has the world's largest churches. And when you're writing a book about extremes of belief and disbelief, then naturally you're drawn to a place where a belief seems strongest. Mm-hmm. And when you've got a congregation of a church at, say, Lakewood, which is 17,500 people, then you sort of certainly get the sense that sort of religion and especially Christianity is still thriving in this country, and in a way that it probably isn't back in my own country.
Mm. Philip Kerr joins us. You just mentioned back in your own country. This protagonist in your book, Prayer, is actually from the same place originally that you are, which is Scotland. And I think it's amazing that he ended up where he is in Houston, working for the FBI.
Well, it is and it isn't, you see. I mean, that was another thing I wanted to do with the book, was to kind of explore my own possible different parallel universe self, if you'll forgive that rather convoluted explanation. I mean, my dad, you see, discovered quite late in his life that the people he thought were his mother and his father were in fact his aunt and his uncle.
Oh.
And his real aunt and his uncle lived in New York and were in service for a rich New York family. She was the housekeeper, he was the butler. And to this day, we still don't know if the butler did it. but the housekeeper got pregnant and gave her child to her then childless sister to bring up as her own, and that was in Scotland. And when my dad discovered this, he was kind of, I suppose, really disappointed, because he really, you know, this was at a time, probably the late 1940s, 1950s, when being American seemed something really enviable. And my dad would dearly love to have been an American.
Mm.
He was a great Americanophile all his life, as indeed I am. And therefore, so when I started writing this book, I sort of tried to imagine the alternative self I might have been and the alternative background I might almost have had, but through a sort of slightly more religious point of view. So, you know, which is why it's partly set in Boston as well. And it seemed a sort of natural place for someone who was a Scots Catholic to end up, right, even down to the inclusion of the, you know, that he supports the Boston Celtics, just that he supported a football team in Glasgow called Celtic. So it just seemed a kind of a good fit, as it were.
Your protagonist, FBI agent Gil Martins, was raised Catholic in Scotland, but now he's in Houston and he's married to a woman who is very involved in one of these Protestant fundamentalist churches, one of these mega churches that you mentioned.
Yeah.
And the marriage is on the rocks.
It's on the rocks for the simple reason that exposure to the worst in society has left the hero, Gil, feeling that it's very hard to believe in God. He doesn't really see God's hand in anything that he spends his day with. So he's got severe doubts, and in fact, the doubts come to a head when his wife finds what she describes as his stash of atheist porn, which is books by sort of Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett. And this sort of is the stimulus for a sort of big argument between the two, which eventually culminates in her asking him to leave. I mean, you know, it seems to me this is a kind of argument that a lot of husbands and wives had. I mean, I wouldn't say my wife and I have had arguments about it. We certainly have spirited discussions about the subject. She's rather more of a Church of England humanist persuasion than I am. I sort of tend to, because I was brought up in Scotland, the God I learned about as a small child was a sort of God of thunder, God of wrath, God of vengeance, a jealous God, to use his own phrase, and not the kind of hallmark Father Christmas kind of God that sort of people tend to believe in now.
An angry, vengeful God.
Yes, again, that's what God says about himself. So I decided when I was writing this to sort of take him at his word, as it were.
Philip Kerr joins us. His new one is Prayer. And you just mentioned some of these gentlemen, Dawkins, etc., one of whom has actually been on this program, the late Christopher Hitchens.
Right, yeah, great Chris.
Yeah, good one. And I was delighted to see that he was included, and people of his ilk are turning up mysteriously dead in your story.
Correct. Well, as I say, I wanted to explore both sides of the, almost like the extreme sides of the religious debate in this country. And I'm very glad it continues to be just a debate, but I want, for the purposes of a thriller, I wanted to see how I could sort of move it on a stage to a moment perhaps when some of these people who are espousing what's called neo-atheism had perhaps learned to fear for their lives.
And Gil has a very interesting relationship with a high-ranking cleric.
Yes, well, sort of based on my own experience, I can't sort of say too much without sort of giving away the identity of the person, but, you know, let's say a kind of free-thinking senior member of the church. Uh-huh. I mean, these are things that are rather more common perhaps in Europe than here.
You knew the Pope?
Well, no, but I mean, it would be, yes, I can see where you're coming from on that one. But I mean, no, I like to have debates with people in religion, and it's not like bear baiting, but it's probably not far off, I've got to admit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've got these people turning up dead, and is it too much of a spoiler to say what's killing them? I mean, it's kind of right in front of your face if you're looking at the book.
Well, what I could say is this, which is that when I came to a number of, I suppose, arrived at a number of insights when I was writing the book. And one of the insights I sort of came to was, I mean, the book's very much, 9/11's very much at the back of a lot of the things that happen. And principally, you know, the hero is someone who'd worked for a firm of attorneys, decides to resign after 9/11 and join the FBI. And actually, that didn't seem to me an atypical experience from my speaking to people in the FBI. These were people very much driven by duty and a sense of patriotism, which I found commendable and slightly inspiring. Sorry, I've forgotten what I was rambling on about. Yeah,
we're talking about the fact that this guy has some connection with 9/11, and
yes, I do beg your pardon. I mean, what I realized was that the guys who'd flown those planes into the towers had prayed. They'd spent a long time praying beforehand, and to some extent they felt their prayers had been answered, which gave them the sort of courage to do what they did. And what it tells me is that prayer is dangerous. You know, if people are prepared to do that, as Truman Capote says, there are more tears shed over answered prayers than unanswered ones.
Mm-hmm.
And although, frankly, I think he stole that from St. Teresa of Avila anyway. It's the sort of thing that even atheists and unbelievers have to watch out for. Everybody has to watch out for people who believe they have a monopoly on truth and who believe they have a kind of direct conduit to God. You see, I'm someone who believes that this is heaven and we're in it, and our natural state is not life, but a kind of atomic state. And for billions of years, that's the only level that we exist in. And it seems, people have said, well, that's rather gloomy. But it seems to me that once you get that sense that, you know, this, as the great Huey Lewis says, this is it, that once you've realized that life is really all there is, then, you know, it takes away the possibility of martyrdom and flying planes into buildings on the absurd promise of some paradise with 72 virgins.
Mm.
So I tend to think that this is a kind of liberating thing to come to realize.
And if this is heaven, we might as well enjoy it. We might as well try to savor every moment while we're there.
Yeah, absolutely. As the poet Horace says, you know, carpe diem, live, you know, seize the day. You know, it seems to me, and quite often the thing about prayer is that people are looking for someone else to sort things out for them, instead of sorting things out for themselves. And it seems to me the essence of a well-lived life is to sort of work for what you want, make it happen yourself. A lot of my children's books were about genies, and it's not so very far away from this, you know, that I used to tell children, well, you know, there's a fundamental difference between a wish and an ambition. And it's much better in life, rather than just have someone give you three wishes, which is a sort of tremendously difficult thing to cope with anyway, in terms of responsibility and how you actually wish the wish. It's much better to have an ambition and to work for it and to make things happen for yourself. And that seems to me the essence of real life, not just sort of on your knees saying, God, please make this happen.
Philip Kerr joins us. Philip, in prayer, you have a lot of this taking place in Galveston, and I didn't realize until I read this story just how devastated that city is.
Well, I was there a couple of years ago. Now, I can't report on how much success they've had in making things better, but it was very hard to imagine when I was there that it could be much better than it was then. The dreadful tragedy of Galveston is that it used to be this fantastic kind of nightclub city where people went to sort of relax and have wonderful holidays. And indeed, some of that beauty can still be seen. But at the same time, it's a devastated place. It's God, and the sense of it being God-forsaken as well is quite powerful. And that made it a kind of automatic choice for my book, because in the same way as William Peter Blatty looked to Georgetown to in The Exorcist to sort of try and find a kind of creepy place to base it. I mean, I was kind of looking for a similar location myself, and Galveston in some ways seemed to fit the bill rather well. I mean, it's impossible to imagine Galveston returning to how it was, because of course this is the last disaster, which I think was called Ike. That was probably the second or third time this had happened in the last 100 years, and each time I guess it becomes more and more expensive to sort of put things back to where they are. But equally, there's the sense that it can easily happen again. And of course now, you know, with climate change, the weather's becoming more and more extreme. And you know, it's easy to imagine it, frankly, happening again down there. I didn't see that's at all impossible. So that was one reason why I picked it. Yeah.
Well, Philip, from your vantage point as a citizen of the United Kingdom, you can observe the United States from afar and then come through and visit and do your own investigating. But we have a culture here where there's a heavy predominance of good old fundamentalist religion. We have a lot of people who deny that climate change is existing. We have a lot of people who are praying for bad things to happen to other people.
Mm-hmm.
You tie all this together in this story.
Well, no, that's true. And yet, I'm personally a big Americanophile. I love the United States, always have. You know, the great thing about this country is the freedom to have the debate. And it's often, you know, people often get tied up in the fact that you know, there's an argument going on and it seems, you know, a difficult thing to have to live with. But, you know, you only have to go to a country like Russia or Iran, where debate is impossible, to appreciate that actually, you know, it's good to argue. It's good to disagree. It's good to say that we have different beliefs and truths. I think, though, what behoves us all is to recognize that when you use a word like truth, it has to apply in an objective, empirical way, that you, any truth that can be properly agreed on as a truth has to be something that's been arrived at through error and experiment. And it's no good just sort of asserting a truth that seems to defy all rationality. I think that's a problem. And if there was something I was trying to push towards in the book, it was that.
I think when some of us think of Texas, we think of those mega churches. We also think of our American gun culture and its supremacy in places like Texas.
Yeah.
That's a debate we have in this country a lot about guns, and yet it just keeps rolling right along.
Well, when I was in Texas, I was struck by the courtesy and politeness of everyone who was there. And I thought to myself, well, possibly that's because they're all armed. I don't know. and I, at the same time, I was thinking, you know, if the Scots, which is the sort of place I come from, if they were armed, I mean, the country would be wiped out in a fortnight because, you know, these are people who are not particularly courteous, not particularly polite. They're in your face, and a lot of them would pick an argument with a mirror. I mean, I've walked through the streets of Glasgow late at night and seen Scots drunks, you know, arguing with a reflection in a shop window. And so, you know, if these people had guns, they you know, the death rate would just spiral. there is a gun debate, but I mean, you know, it's hard to see the genie being put back into that bottle somehow.
I understand from reading the press material that came with your new novel, Prayer, Philip, that you did get some good help and cooperation from the FBI.
Oh yeah, you bet. They were terrific. They couldn't have been more open and friendly. The complete opposite, again, of the kind of G-man, poker-faced men in black that most people imagine the FBI to be. These guys were young, often quite liberally minded, inclined to be democratic in a political way. I was lucky. I mean, I was very lucky that I was able to write to them with a very good reference. I said, you know, when I wrote to them, I said, look, I'd like to come spend maybe a few days with you. And if you want to check out my security bona fides. Here's the name and email of a fan, and I was able to give them the supreme allied commander of NATO in Europe, who's an American admiral.
Wow.
James Trevelyan, great guy. And I'd been to his command headquarters in Europe. So, once you're able to sort of, say, well, look, you can write to this guy and he'll tell you I'm straight.
You name dropper.
Yes. and a special thanks to the admiral for that, by the way. He's no longer, I think he's the dean of a college in America now.
You have a character in this novel, Prayer, who is a minister at a mega church and quite a compelling character. How did you create that character? Did you study these types of individuals, or did you actually talk to any of them? How did you do it?
Well, I remembered what a lot of them were like, because when I was a child, sitting in church every Sunday, in fact, we went to church sometimes as many as three times on a Sunday, because I went to Sunday school in the afternoon. There would be a sort of, quite often, at least once or twice a month, there'd be a visiting pastor sometimes from the United States, sometimes from Canada, sometimes from England, whatever. And so I got a fairly broad selection then of what the kind of things they said. When I was writing the character, I mean, my starting point was kind of Upton Sinclair's Elmer Gantry, who seems to me to be the starting point for any book about sort of preachers and religion.
You meant Sinclair Lewis, by the way.
Sinclair Lewis, okay. Yes, I do beg your pardon.
And, no worries.
So that was where I started. It's odd now because the man has achieved such huge popularity as an actor with a couple of recent roles. But the person I sort of kind of had in mind when I was thinking if this was ever a movie and I was going to cast the preacher in this, who's called Nelson van der Velden, would be Matthew McConaughey, you see, because I thought, well, he's Texan, he's smooth, he's charismatic, he's got a big, easy smile. So he's my idea of what a perfect kind of Texan preacher would look like and sound like.
I think my favorite character in this new novel, Prayer, has to be this scientist who he tracks down, who is probably on the list of people that are going to be suspiciously killed. And she's a pretty flammable character. I really liked her a lot.
I liked her a lot, too, and I felt a responsibility for her, which is that I don't want to say too much about her, but
yeah.
She was his chance, his shot at a kind of redemption, that there was a woman out there for him who felt the same way, and yet it doesn't quite go to plan, but it never does, so, that kind of reflects real life, I think,
Well, I was treading lightly there. I didn't want to give anything away other than the fact that she is a she. And the ending, whoa, we won't even go there. I mean, what a surprise that
was. Well, I'm glad you thought that. I mean, just Shades of 1984. I mean, I don't think that'll give it away actually too much. But it's essentially the same conclusions shared by Gil that are shared by Winston Smith. At the end of 1984, and again, that doesn't give it away, but I think you'll know exactly what I mean.
I do. Philip Kerr joins us. His new novel is Prayer, and this is I guess you'd call it a standalone, because for those of you who have heard him on the program before, he was always here talking about Bernie Gunther, his long-running series, and when I knew, having talked to you a year ago for the last Bernie book, that you weren't going to be putting out another Bernie book for quite some time, if at all, that I had to go back and get my Bernie Gunther fix. And I went back and I read the first three books, which are now available as the Berlin Noir Trilogy. And
correct.
I read them and I thought, these are a lot more raw and profane than I remembered compared to the later works. And then I read the press material and I see where there's some kind of an HBO thing going on here. Can you talk about that?
There's not a huge amount to talk about, really, to be honest. I mean, there's there's HBO are keen to sort of take it to turn it into a kind of TV series, along the kind of Game of Thrones
TV series.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Which would be great, but I've learned to sort of be patient and to sort of play down all of these things until they actually happen, because there's nothing more foolish, I think, than writers talking about films and TV that hasn't yet happened, because life has habits of, has a way of making you look foolish. I mean, I've sold so many books to movie companies over the years, and nothing's happened, except that, I've managed to bank a few decent-sized checks. And so I live in hope. I think that's the best way to describe it, that something will happen. It would be great to see what they'd make of it.
Well, from my vantage point, as someone who talks to writers about these many projects that are out there in the ether and so few of them actually come to fruition, I guess where I see them is they're always in the press release. They're always in the, and it's been optioned, and it's been blah, blah, blah. But I feel it's great because, like you say, they still pay you, whether they make it or not.
I look on it like a kind of Arts Council grant that enables me to keep doing what I'm doing for the next thing, and, if it gets made, it's a bonus.
Uh-huh.
Really, or most of the time it's a bonus. Sometimes there are some writers I know who've not been entirely happy with what's resulted. But it's a crapshoot, really.
Mm.
So you live with that or you don't, and you either engage with it or you don't. So I have a lot of dealings with people in Hollywood, and I'm aware of the imperatives that they have to work to. It's terribly expensive to make stuff, and so I don't hold anyone to account and say, "Oh, these people let me down because they didn't make my stuff." I think sometimes they just it's easy to forget just how much stuff really costs to make. So it's a big commitment to make something.
And more every day.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad, Philip, that we were able to you back on the program, because I know you've been on a book tour and you're headed back to London tonight.
That's right.
And so we were able to get you in these waning moments of your U.S. tour. And
that's right. There's only one thing worse than doing an American book tour, and that's not being asked to do an American book tour.
And I am an optimist, and I know in my heart someday – I'm dreaming there's going to be another Bernie Gunther book.
Oh, there will, certainly, and probably someday soon. It's just that, I felt the need for a short vacation from Nazi Germany, as it were.
Well, thank you so much, Philip.
Thank you, Vic.
You've been listening to Book Nook on WYSO. Our guest has been Philip Kerr. His new novel is Prayer. At 2 o'clock on Saturday, June 7th, I'll be at Books & Company interviewing best-selling author Khaled Hosseini for his latest book. He sold over 40 million copies of his previous two. Hope to see you. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.